Well, I hope you noted that Tuesday, March the 1st was St David's Day, patron saint of Wales, and the Welsh rugby team leads the Five Nations competition. And you may know that the rugby crowd at Cardiff Arms Park has recorded several albums of music. They're singing now. But why is this so significant in evolutionary terms?
In effect, over the course of human evolution, we increased the size of our communities threefold, up to about 150. And that meant we had to find some other way of creating this endorphin kick with more individuals than grooming allows you to do. And what seems to have happened is we've brought into play successively several different activities which turn out to be very, very good at kicking the endorphin system in. The first one was laughter, which actually we share with great apes, but we just kind of redesigned it a bit to make it produce a bigger endorphin hit. And that clearly allowed us to increase group size quite a bit more than what seems to have kicked in somewhere probably around about 500,000 years ago is music, and particularly singing and dancing. But both of those really increase the size of the grooming group. It means you can groom with lots of individuals simultaneously. In fact, probably it's almost unlimited the number of individuals you can have in a singing group or a dancing group.
First we groomed, picking nits, that felt nice. Then we hummed and sang and danced and could hold much bigger groups of people united together. This week on Catalyst, Jonica Newby talks to Robin Dunbar in Oxford about music and the brain.
Music really, in many ways, just fundamental to our ability to hold together large communities of individuals. Because the problem we had, or at least our ancestors had in the course of later human evolution, was trying to bond ever larger communities, communities beyond the size that you could bond by the classic mechanisms that monkeys and apes use, which is grooming each other. And what music does is kick in the same physiological mechanisms that underpin grooming and make grooming the ideal primate way of creating relationships, bonding social groups.
So do you think we could have become us if we hadn't developed musicality?
I don't think it would have been possible. I mean, what's made us as we are now was the need to dramatically increase the size of our social groups, our communities, largely for the same reasons that monkeys and apes live in social groups anyway, that's to say defence and protection. And monkeys and apes face a kind of constraint, really, in terms of time, from the fact that grooming is very much a one-on-one activity, as it still is with us. That means there's, in the end, just an upper limit on the number of individuals you can bond with social grooming, and therefore the size of the group you can bond together by that mechanism. And if we were to kind of break through that glass ceiling, we had to have a mechanism which allowed us, in effect, to groom with many more individuals simultaneously. And music and dancing is one of the things that allows us to do that, because there's no limit, because you're not actually physically touching somebody. There's no upper limit on the number of individuals you can, in effect, groom. You might think of this as grooming at a distance rather than grooming physically.
You're comparing music with grooming, but what do you mean?
Well, the reason grooming works as a bonding device, and still does with us, it comes out as touching and stroking and patting and cuddling and so on. It's this sort of light leafing through the fur that monkeys and apes do when they're grooming, triggers the endorphin system in the brain. The endorphin system is part of the pain control mechanism. So endorphins are opiates, or they're very similar to things like morphine chemically. They produce this kind of opiate high. You feel very relaxed and happy with whoever you're doing it with, and that creates a kind of pharmacological basis for a friendship, if you like, for a social relationship. And that's how primates bond their groups. Now, it turns out that singing and dancing kick in exactly the same mechanisms. It triggers the endorphin system, partly because the endorphin system is really responding to anything that puts stress on the body. And singing is a slightly awkward, physiologically awkward activity, puts stress on the diaphragm and the chest wall and so on. And obviously dancing involves physical movement. And it's these kinds of light, low-level stresses, Jogging is another way of doing it if you want, but jogging tends not to be a social activity. And the whole point about singing and dancing is they're intensely social, highly, highly synchronized. And it's that synchrony of this activity combined with this sort of light levels of stress on the muscle system that is very, very good at triggering the endorphin system.
On the face of it, music seems like it might be a really late development, one of those, I won't say trivial, but sort of flourishes that humans have come up with, and it's not really that important. But you don't think that at all anymore.
Oh, no, no. Music really has played an absolutely central role in later human evolution. I mean, we can't say exactly when it evolved, but we get some pretty good insight from the anatomical changes related to breathing control. Because what's critical about singing is this ability to maintain long exhalations under very tight breath control. And remember, this is singing without words. This is chorusing. But it all comes down to this ability to manage breath control and maintain these long exhalations, which incidentally is a key precursor for speech, because we wouldn't have language if we couldn't do that. So you can see music providing the precursor for the evolution of language later on. Now, we don't know exactly when it would have evolved, but we have some clues in terms of the anatomical underpinnings for singing in particular, because singing requires this really intense control over the chest wall muscles to maintain these long, slow exhalations of sound, which incidentally actually provide the precursors for language, because that long, slow exhalation is absolutely crucial for the production of speech. So without that, we would never have had language evolve. So singing clearly evolves before language. The anatomical changes involved in it, which are predominantly the size of the neural channels down through the upper spine in the chest, which control the muscles and so on in the chest wall and the diaphragm and allow you to squeeze air, as it were, to produce these long exhalations. Those changes, plus other anatomical changes elsewhere, all seem to occur at about 500,000 years ago, which is the point at which archaic humans first appear. So you probably got from about 500,000 years ago until about 200,000 years ago, when our own species appears, Homo sapiens. You've probably got this long, long period when singing and dancing were playing a really fundamental role in creating these large bonded communities.
So music is pivotal.
Music is absolutely pivotal in the course of human evolution. It's pivotal not just for producing these bigger communities that we can live in, which provide more effective defense against predators and so on. It's also critical, and particularly singing, in providing the precursors for language.
Well, you can imagine the singing, the vocal communication. Lots of animals have vocal communication, but why does it make us move?
It's a very good question as to why human singing in the form it does actually evolved. I mean, it's questionable whether other animals sing in the same way that we do. Clearly, they can be very musical, many birds, obviously, gibbons singing, these kind of things. We hear it as very musical, but it's questionable as to whether the animals themselves hear it in the same sort of way. In other words, we kind of attach meaning to the sounds and they provide these uplift and so on that we get from music. And it's not clear whether or not animals do. And at the end of the day, most animal singing is advertising rather than chorusing. You rarely get chorusing in the way that we have it with singing and dancing in humans. In effect, what we've done is ramp up the effect of music by making it intensely social.
And the movement aspect, the dancing, you don't really see that in other animals.
Yes, you kind of do. You actually get a lot of dancing going on in the courtship displays in birds. And the whole thing about dancing is it's highly, highly synchronized. And it's that synchrony of behavior where you're both doing exactly the same moves together that seems to ramp up this endorphin effect. It's almost magic, really, because it doubles the endorphin hit you get out of it. And we don't understand why. We simply have no idea. But the fact is, it does it. And what's interesting is you can see some really nice examples of this kind of synchronized display in many bird species. I mean, the classic one is the grebes, the water birds, who dance along the water, the male and the female, doing these courtship displays, you know, flapping their wings and stuff. And it's quite extraordinary. just aside from the fact they're walking on water, the synchrony with which they do it, it's like synchronized swimming. It's just amazing to watch. We originally showed this effect with rowers, 8-man racing crews. If they're rowing on their own, they get an endorphin hit just from the physical exercise. If they row as a boat together, 8 people in a boat all in total synchrony, it ramps the endorphin effect up massively. And we know it's not because they're putting more effort in. It's just something to do with the behavioural synchrony itself somehow is triggering this extra endorphin release.
Robin Dunbar, professor in Oxford, on Catalyst, talking about music and the brain, 8 p.m. Tuesday, ABC Television with Jonica Newby. But more on those animals from a BBC programme winning gold at the AAAS.
It's one of the most fascinating things that we do as humans, and it's also a mystery that people have been trying to study for years and years and years, and still it eludes us.
We know that language appeared in evolution just out of the blue, perhaps 100,000 years ago. But it's a huge mystery.
If you look somewhere in the animal kingdom for some kind of parallel for language, obviously you should be looking at our closest relatives, at chimpanzees, for instance. But our closest relatives don't behave like us at all in that respect, but songbirds, for some reason, do.
I guess the most fascinating thing about it is the way kids are able to acquire this incredibly sophisticated toolkit without needing to be taught it in any kind of formal way.
For me, as a parent, just how an infant goes from babbling to vocalising words and then stringing those words into sentences is remarkable. There are lots of theories about how we acquire language, but even more mysterious is the question of how it evolved in the first place. Fundamental to answering this is the matter of whether language is unique to humans or whether elements of it can be found in other species. In particular, if the key to its complexity may be tweeting in the trees above us right now. In 1871, Charles Darwin was amongst the first biologists to note the similarities between birdsong and human language in The Descent of Man.
The sounds uttered by birds offer in several aspects the nearest analogy to language, for all the members of the same species utter the same instinctive cries expressive of their emotions.
Darwin's thoughts reflect just how much we humans relate to birdsong. Poetry and literature are a testament to our love of it. But is there something more to this? Does our connection go beyond appreciation of its beauty? Is there a deeper biological link between birds and humans, as Darwin implied?
So this is the song of an adult zebrafinch father. And now we hear the song of one of his sons. He's got two sons here, and they've been exposed to the sound of the father, and this is what one of the sons comes up with when he's an adult himself.
So it's pretty similar to what the father is singing.
Yeah, so he's copied very well, but this is another son of the same father. So he still has a long way to go.
Not as sophisticated as his brother.
No, but it could be that with more practice that he reaches the same level.
Johan Bullhaus is a professor of cognitive neurobiology at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands, and he works with zebrafinches, small Australian songbirds with bright orange beaks, often used for this kind of research. He's trying to unite biology and linguistics, two fields that have traditionally had very different approaches to the question of how language might have arisen.
The way that children learn to speak is very similar to the way that songbirds learn to sing. They have to learn their songs from an adult individual. So early in life, the zebrafinch learns much more easily than later in life, and at some stage it can't learn anymore at all. And something similar happens in humans, that a young child can learn a language very quickly and can learn several languages at the same time, like my daughter did once. And then also, if you look at the way that speech develops and that birdsong develops, there are interesting parallels there too, that there are different phases. So there is what we call in human infants, we call babbling. So they make funny little sounds and they haven't got a clue what they're saying, but they make those sounds. And then very gradually they start to pronounce real words and maybe even sentences at some stage. And more or less the same thing happens in songbirds. They also listen to their parent. And then first they make sort of little squeaky sounds like human infants, and then very gradually they start to make real bird song sounds. And they're quite comparable to the brain structures that are involved in human infant speech acquisition. And also what we found recently is that the two halves of the brain, we have a left part and the right part of the brain, it's mainly the left part of the brain that's involved in speech and language in humans. And we found exactly the same in the songbirds, that they also, the young songbirds, they process song that they hear from their father, for instance, particularly with the left part of the brain.
A BBC programme produced by Rami Sabar and presented by Angela Saini that won the Gold Award at the AAAS meeting in Washington, D.C. Here's more.
An hour's train ride from Utrecht is another bird lab filled with zebra finches, this time run by Professor Carlton Carter at the University of Leiden. He's scoured the animal kingdom in search of vocal learners.
So there are about 27 or 28 different groups of birds. All 10,000 bird species fit into one of those groups. And of all those groups, there are only three in which vocal learning is present. It's the parrots, which we of course all know by their imitation. It's the songbirds, like the zebra finches we are working with. And then it's the hummingbirds. And it's probably the case that the ancestor of all those groups evolved vocal learning, because virtually all songbirds we know of demonstrate vocal learning, and the same with the parrots. So that means that it has evolved three times independently. And in mammals, it's also a rare thing. It's only present in humans, among the apes, as far as we know, and among all the monkeys. It's present in bats. It's present in dolphins and whales, in sea lions. And there are a few reports of elephants who actually also are able to vocal imitate.
What the Songbird Said, gold winner of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, from BBC World Service, The Science Show on RN.